Today is Friday, May 15, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 28 to 31 minutes, we'll cover mounting evidence that Russia's war economy is approaching a structural breaking point, with casualty figures and recruitment declines that researchers say exceed replacement capacity, alongside a CNN investigation into a sunken cargo ship that may have been carrying nuclear reactor components bound for North Korea, and a pair of CSI's panels that lay out, in unusual analytical detail, why China will not constrain Pyongyang and why South Korea has no claim. We begin with Russia, and with a question that has been asked repeatedly since February 2022, but is now being answered with more precision: how much strain can Russia's war economy actually absorb before something breaks? The data presented this week across multiple panels and independent research outlets paints a picture of a system under serious stress, not collapse, not imminent defeat, but a system in which the inputs required to sustain the war are degrading faster than the Kremlin can compensate. Start with casualties. Dr. Sam Green, professor of Russian politics at King's College London, speaking on the CSIS Russian Roulette podcast recorded May 8, stated that Russian frontline casualties are running at an estimated 35,000 to 40,000 per month. He described that figure as above the replacement rate. That assessment lines up with battlefield data from Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, which claimed 35,351 Russian casualties in March 2026, with 96% of those recorded by drone, according to Al Jazeera, and a further 35,203 casualties in April. Independent Russian outlets Medusa and Mediazona published a joint investigation on May 9th that adds significant weight to those numbers, using probate registry checks, a methodologically careful approach that avoids reliance on official Russian disclosures. They confirmed at least 352,000 Russian men aged 18 to 59 have been killed since the war began. This is not a Ukrainian government figure, it comes from Russian legal records. Building on that, recruitment is now moving in the wrong direction. United 24 Media reported on May 4th that April was the fifth consecutive month in which Russia failed to recruit enough volunteers to offset losses. Military analysis outlet Militarny reported that Russia recruited approximately 800 soldiers per day during the first quarter of 2026, down from 1,000 to 1,200 per day during the same period in 2025. That is a decline of at least 20% year-on-year, and the trend line is not improving. On the economic side, the picture is similarly constrained. Green assessed that Russia has been unable to generate meaningful economic growth for approximately 12 to 13 years, with the exception of a limited period of what he called war Keynesianism. Essentially, military spending as an economic stimulus. He cited stagnating or falling salaries, reports of salary arrears, and prices continuing to rise. Matthew Bryza, a former U.S. National Security Council official speaking on the War and Politics 24 channel, added that Russian banks have been directed by the Kremlin to extend loans to the defense sector that frequently cannot be repaid. Meanwhile, interest rates have been raised to combat high inflation, which is weighing on broader investment. The Jason J. Smart transcript cited a Russian federal budget deficit of $73 billion. Russian refining output was reported at approximately 4.69 million barrels per day, described as the lowest level since 2009, with six refineries disrupted in April and early May following Ukrainian strikes. On public sentiment, polling data suggests the war is beginning to erode the political foundation the Kremlin has relied on. Levada Center data, cited by Green, shows the share of Russians who believe the country is heading in the right direction has fallen well below pre-invasion levels. Kremlin-affiliated pollster Vyer Vakum separately reported a decline of approximately 10 to 12 percentage points in Putin's approval rating, with approval now reportedly sitting at 65 to 66%, according to Maria Snegovaya, senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia at CSIS. Snegovaya drew a historically grounded parallel. After Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea, elevated approval held for approximately 4 years before eroding. She suggested a similar arc may now be underway from the 2022 invasion baseline, meaning if that pattern holds, erosion could deepen further through 2026 and into 2027. On the battlefield itself, April 2026 produced an outcome worth noting. The Institute for the Study of War reported that April was Russia's first month of net territorial loss inside Ukraine since Ukraine's summer counteroffensive of 2023. Ukraine recorded a net gain of 120 square kilometers by month's end. Deep State reported Russia seized 672 square kilometers during the spring period overall, trailing the 827 square kilometers seized during the comparable period in 2025, according to the Kyiv Independent. The National Interest reported approximately 10,000 Russian casualties in just the first week of the renewed spring offensive, including a single-day loss of 1,710 soldiers on March 17th, described as the highest single-day figure recorded in 2026. The technology dimension is reshaping this conflict in ways that affect cost calculations on both sides. The Kyiv Independent and Politico both report that drones now account for up to 80% of battlefield casualties. Ukraine's use of first-person view drones enables strikes at approximately 10% of the cost of a single artillery shell against a static position. The Center for European Policy Analysis assessed that ground robotic systems could reduce Ukraine's frontline infantry requirements by as much as 30% by end 2026. The Associated Press separately reported a striking demonstration of drone effectiveness during NATO exercises on Gotland Island in Sweden. Ukrainian drone operators effectively neutralized Swedish forces, compelling the Swedish side to halt exercises three times and revise tactics.
That exercise outcome is being studied closely in defense ministries across Europe. On negotiations, Russian presidential spokesman Peskov stated this week that Russia is prepared to restart peace talks only if Ukraine orders its armed forces to cease fire and withdraw from the Donbas and other designated Russian territorial regions. Russia assessed that Yuri Ushakov framed a May 9th ceasefire proposal as a Trump initiative to re-engage U.S. mediation, and that Ushakov's subsequent withdrawal threat was a tactical maneuver to pressure Washington into pressing Kyiv on territorial concessions. Green's baseline scenario for the next 12 months is continued attritional warfare. He assessed, notably, that European long-term commitment to Ukraine actually increases the probability of an earlier end to the conflict, because Russian strategy is predicated on European patience exhausting first. Max Bergman, director of the Stewart Center at CSIS, cited a $90 billion European commitment to Ukraine and noted that Hungarian Prime Minister Orbán's blockage of EU funds has ended. With that commitment sustained and growing, Green's logic holds. The Russian calculus for waiting out the West becomes harder to sustain. Before we leave Russia entirely, two domestic dynamics worth tracking. Bergman described widespread internet outages in Moscow and St. Petersburg, an FSB-led crackdown on Telegram and VPNs, and efforts to push users toward a Russian state-affiliated messaging application called Max. And Snegovaya raised reporting of a feud between Defense Minister Belousov and presidential administration official Kiryenko over United Russia's electoral lists ahead of Duma elections, specifically over which figures linked to the special military operation would receive parliamentary seats.
Green assessed that intra-elite competition at this stage is primarily over rents, not ideology, and noted ongoing arrests in the defense ministry. Denis Butsayev, described as a former deputy minister of natural resources and environment, reportedly fled to the United States following dismissal on corruption charges, though Green declined to characterize this as a politically motivated elite defection. Now to a story that has received less coverage than it deserves. A CNN investigation published May 12th into the sinking of a Russian cargo vessel and what its captain allegedly told Spanish investigators about the ship's true cargo. The vessel is called the Ursa Major. It sank on December 23, 2024, approximately 60 miles off the coast of Spain, following a series of explosions. Russia's foreign ministry attributed the incident to an engine room explosion. That was BBC reporting from December 24. Two crew members were killed. 14 survivors were rescued by Spanish authorities. What makes this story significant is what CNN uncovered about what the ship was actually carrying, or allegedly carrying.
The Ursa Major was a sanctioned ship, previously known as Sparta III. It had departed St. Petersburg 12 days before it sank. Its public manifest listed two large cranes and 129 empty shipping containers, with Vladivostok listed as the destination. But under questioning by Spanish investigators, the ship's captain, Igor Anisimov, told authorities the Ursa Major was transporting components for two submarine nuclear reactors. Anisimov stated the reactors contained no fuel, and that he believed Vladivostok was a cover destination, that the actual delivery was intended for North Korea. CNN reported that satellite photographs of Ust-Luga port, taken around the time of loading, showed two white pill-shaped objects that CNN assessed were consistent with VM-4SG reactor pressure vessels. Those objects were absent from photographs taken approximately 1 week later. The ship held a license to carry nuclear materials. Spain's investigation concluded the cause of the sinking was a supercavitating Barracuda-type torpedo, based on a 50 by 50 centimeter inward-facing hull breach. However, Mike Plunkett, senior naval platforms analyst at Jane's, offered a competing assessment to CNN, stating the damage was consistent with a limpet mine or shaped charge. Nations possessing Barracuda-type torpedoes include Russia, the United States, and several NATO states, with Germany as the original developer. Approximately 12 units were reportedly produced, but the weapon never entered official procurement. The Pentagon, Spanish authorities, and UK authorities all declined to comment. What happened afterward is also notable. The ship's owner, Oberon Logistics, characterized the incident as a targeted terrorist attack. The United States deployed WC-135R nuclear detection aircraft to the wreck site, first on August 28, 2025, and again on February 6, 2026, per CNN. The Russian vessel Yantar returned to the site approximately 1 week after the sinking. The New Voice of Ukraine reported on May 13 that four additional seabed explosions were subsequently detected near the wreck. The North Korea connection is not incidental. The Center for Strategic and International Studies noted that North Korea announced a goal of developing a nuclear-powered submarine in 2021 as part of a five-year weapons plan. Kim Jong-un reiterated that desire during the January 2024 testing of a submarine-launched cruise missile. Also from the Jason J. Smart transcript this week, Russia conducted a test launch of its Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, described as only the second successful launch since development began, following a launch site explosion in 2024. Russia has promoted the Sarmat since at least 2018, as capable of carrying nuclear warheads over distances exceeding 35,000 kilometers. The day of the launch, Alexander Gavlov, identified as director of the Sarmat production facility, was detained on embezzlement charges. A new Russian Air Force commander was appointed on the same day, an officer whose career background was in armored vehicles rather than aviation or aerospace. And separately, at least 12 hypersonic aerodynamic specialists have faced treason charges in Russia since 2018, with sentences ranging from 12.5 to 15 years. We turn now to Northeast Asia, where two CSIS panels on May 15th produced some of the sharpest analytical clarity we have seen in months on China's Korea calculus and South Korea's Taiwan dilemma. These two sessions, taken together, illuminate a regional security architecture that is under simultaneous stress from multiple directions. The first panel was framed as a simple question: has China been helpful on North Korea? The consensus among participants was an unambiguous no. Chong Park, distinguished associate fellow at the Free University of Brussels and a former senior CIA official, stated Beijing's role has been, in his words, incredibly unhelpful. Patricia Kim, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's John L. Thornton China Center, reframed the question in a way that sharpens the analysis considerably. She argued the question itself may be too charitable. China has been indispensable not to resolving the North Korea problem, but to North Korea's survival. Beijing has served as Pyongyang's principal patron, primary military ally, economic lifeline, and diplomatic shield. Kim attributed this posture not to ideological alignment, but to Beijing's desire to preserve sphere of influence control over a strategically critical peninsula. The CSI's moderator outlined a historical pattern worth understanding. Chinese cooperation on North Korea has historically emerged only when Beijing feared being sidelined by USDPRK diplomacy or perceived imminent U.S. escalation. Two specific periods were cited, the post-2002 Axis of Evil period and the 2017 Fire and Fury period, when Beijing supported UN Security Council sanctions resolutions. Outside of those windows, cooperation has been minimal. Chung Park noted that following the 2010 Cheonan attack, which killed 46 South Korean sailors, and the Yeonpyeong Island attack, which killed 4 South Koreans, China called for restraint without assigning responsibility to Pyongyang. That pattern of studied neutrality in the face of North Korean provocation is not accidental. It reflects a strategic calculation. Rush Toshi, CV Star Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and a former NSC Deputy Senior Director for China and Taiwan, described what happened when the Biden administration tried to engage China seriously on North Korea. Every time the White House raised the issue, at the presidential level or below, the Chinese side declined serious discussion and blamed the United States. Toshi identified 3 specific requests that were rejected: deniable U.S.-China cooperation on COVID vaccine delivery to North Korea, brokering more substantive USDPRK communication, and coordination on the nuclear program. China's response to concerns about Russian DPRK involvement in the Ukraine war was, in Toshi's characterization, essentially, what can we do about it? The Russia-DPRK Mutual Defense Pact, signed in June 2024, added a new complication to this picture. Patricia Kim stated that following that signing, Beijing noticeably intensified outreach to North Korea, including a red carpet reception for Kim Jong-un. Victor Cha of CICSAIS, in closing remarks, stated that China and Russia have effectively accepted North Korea as a nuclear weapons state, moving away from any genuine interest in denuclearization. Cha offered a counterintuitive but analytically important assessment. Russian influence over the DPRK is actually worse for U.S. interests than Chinese influence, because China still opposes a 7th North Korean nuclear test, while Russia, in his assessment, does not. The CSIS moderator noted internally that the Russia-DPRK relationship could represent 5 to 10 years of strategic value to Russia if sustained. One more indicator of where Beijing's attention actually lies, Sun Mencho, associate professor at Sungkyunkwan University, noted that the Korean Peninsula was entirely absent from China's official statement at the 2 sessions this year, whereas it had been present the prior year. He assessed that Beijing is deliberately waiting for Seoul and Washington to become more dependent on Chinese facilitation before engaging, rather than being genuinely uncertain how to respond. The second CSIS panel convened the same day and addressed a related but distinct problem: what South Korea would actually do in the event of a Taiwan conflict. The findings were structured around a wargaming project, and the picture they produced is one of inescapable trade-offs with no clean exit. Mark Kanian, senior advisor at CSIS, described running approximately 70 wargames. In 19 of 25 games, China attacked Japan, drawing Tokyo into the conflict. That matters for Seoul because of what it implies about escalation geometry. A Taiwan conflict does not stay contained to the Taiwan Strait. Sun Mencho, associate professor at Sungkyunkwan University, laid out the core dilemma facing any South Korean government. Andrew Yeo of the Brookings Institution provided the baseline: 90% of South Korean trade flows through the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea. From that starting point, Seoul faces 2 bad options. Full non-participation risks economic coercion if China prevails. Full combat participation invites Chinese strikes on South Korean bases and risks North Korean opportunistic aggression, effectively opening a second front on the Korean Peninsula. President Lee Jae-myung's position on this question has evolved in revealing ways. During the 2024 legislative elections, he stated a Taiwan contingency had nothing to do with South Korea. After taking office, when Time magazine asked him the same question directly, he declined to answer, saying he would consider it if aliens invaded the Earth. Cho assessed this shift toward strategic ambiguity benefits China, which South Korea requires as an interlocutor for inter-Korean dialogue. In other words, Seoul's political need for Beijing's cooperation on the North Korea file creates structural constraints on how clearly it can align with Washington on Taiwan. Jason Xu, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former Taiwanese legislator, stated his government was tracking two specific outcomes from President Trump's summit in Beijing: whether Trump would shift U.S. language from not supporting to opposing Taiwan independence, and whether Trump would delay the second tranche of a defense package worth a total of $25 billion, $11 billion approved in January 2026, with $14 billion still pending. Kanyan separately raised a more alarming scenario that has entered public discussion: a possible arrangement in which China receives some voice on U.S. arms sales to Taiwan in exchange for Chinese assistance in the Strait of Hormuz. He assessed such a deal would be harmful to Taiwan and would set a precedent with significant implications for allied deployments across the region. This remains speculative, but the fact that it is being seriously modeled in policy circles is itself a data point. On the question of whether conflict is imminent, Cho cited a March 2026 Office of the Director of National Intelligence annual threat assessment. The DNI assessed that China is unlikely to invade Taiwan by 2027, citing PLA readiness concerns linked to ongoing anti-corruption purges within the People's Liberation Army. That is a notable near-term reassessment, though analysts consistently caution that readiness can improve and political decisions can shift rapidly. Polling adds another dimension. Cho cited data showing approximately 67% of Taiwan's general population would fight if China invades, but only 31% of those in their 20s and 30s said they would fight to the death. A 2024 Chicago Council on Global Affairs poll found that 18% of American respondents supported direct U.S. military intervention in a Taiwan contingency, 60% opposed, and approximately 20% were undecided. On the practical question of how Taiwan survives a blockade, Kanyan assessed that Taiwan maintains roughly 6 months of food inventory, but that natural gas would be exhausted after approximately 2 to 3 weeks. Xu added that discussions have taken place among Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan regarding a potential LNG supply swap arrangement involving Alaska LNG infrastructure, designed to resupply U.S. military bases and sustain Taiwan's energy supply during a blockade scenario. That conversation is preliminary, but its existence indicates that contingency planning at the operational level is more advanced than public debate suggests. Now to a story that sits at the intersection of U.S. domestic politics and African diplomacy. The Foreign Policy Research Institute's Africa program convened a panel this week on the state of U.S.-South Africa relations following the arrival of U.S. Ambassador Brent Bozell in Pretoria. The assessment from panelists was blunt: the relationship is not in recovery, it is in damage containment. Bob Wesa, from the Africa Center for the Study of the U.S. in Johannesburg, characterized Bozell's task as preventing a complete breakdown rather than restoring warmth. He noted that China-South Africa trade volume is nearly double that of U.S.-South Africa trade, and that more than 600 companies registered with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce operate in South Africa. A reminder that economic engagement continues even as political relations fray. Michael Walsh, identified as being at the University of Alaska, outlined five stated priorities the Trump administration set for Ambassador Bozell: reducing South Africa's relationship with Iran, addressing the "Kill the Boer" song as hate speech, challenging broad-based black economic empowerment laws as they affect U.S. companies, contesting land expropriation without compensation legislation, and advancing the administration's framing on what it calls white genocide, which Walsh said the administration... Walsh's assessment: Bozell has not achieved clear progress on any of these five objectives to date. The white Afrikaner refugee issue has become a particular point of friction. Panelist David Monet described the Trump administration's position on granting refugee status to white Afrikaner South Africans as unfortunate, attributing it in part to the influence of South African-born businessman Elon Musk. Wesson noted that even the Democratic Alliance, generally aligned with U.S. positions in South African politics, has not endorsed refugee status for white South Africans. He also observed that crime in South Africa disproportionately affects black South Africans, a point that complicates the administration's framing. On the G20 exclusion, Walsh described South Africa's disinvitation from the G20 summit to be held at the U.S. President's Golf Resort in Miami as retaliatory. He noted that South Africa had an opportunity at the G20 it hosted the prior year to address Trump administration priorities and chose not to. Walsh assessed the Ramaphosa government has larger strategic priorities than securing a summit invitation, which is either a sign of resilience or a measure of how far the relationship has drifted depending on your vantage point. Despite all of this, both sides have kept channels open. Weza assessed the nomination of Rolf Meyer, a central negotiator at the CODESA talks alongside President Cyril Ramaphosa in the early 1990s, as South Africa's new Washington ambassador as a wise and deliberate choice. Meyer's history as a bridge builder gives him credibility that a career diplomat might not. Monet noted that South Africa's decision not to reject Bosel's credentials, despite having grounds to do so, demonstrated Pretoria's willingness to preserve the possibility of a reset. The Iran dimension is more complicated than often presented. Wesa describes South Africa's position as supporting Iran on sanctions matters, while being critical on human rights, a distinction that Washington tends not to make. He described an incident involving Iran's participation in South African naval exercises as revealing a coordination weakness, with the presidency reportedly opposed to Iranian participation while the defense establishment proceeded regardless. Walsh noted that South Africa's ICJ action against Israel has led some U.S. advocates to call for South Africa to be designated a state sponsor of terrorism. He also pointed out that Malaysia, another participant in the ICJ Hague Group, has not faced equivalent U.S. pressure, which he linked to a critical minerals agreement between the U.S. and Malaysia. Finally, NATO cohesion and European defense posture, a thread running through several of this week's sources that is worth pulling together. Matthew Breiza stated that President Trump has announced plans to withdraw significantly more than 5,000 U.S. troops from Germany and is considering withdrawals from Italy and Spain. Trump has linked these moves to those countries' refusal to support U.S. and Israeli military operations against Iran. Breiza assessed that these withdrawals undermine the credibility of NATO's Article 5 mutual defense commitment, weaken transatlantic solidarity, and reduce U.S. leverage with Russia in any prospective Ukraine settlement. He specifically identified Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia as potential targets for sub-threshold Russian military actions modeled on the 2014 Crimea playbook, were NATO deterrence to erode. That is not a fringe concern. It is an assessment grounded in Russian operational history. On the European side, commitment to Ukraine remains substantial. Bergman cited the $90 billion European commitment, and a speaker at what the War and Politics 24 channel described as a Bucharest NATO summit stated that the European support package is expected to be operational no later than early June, with an initial tranche directed toward drone production. The same speaker called for the opening of the first EU membership cluster for Ukraine and expressed uncertainty about the outcome of the NATO summit scheduled in Turkey in July, citing existing difficulties in U.S.-Europe relations. A U.S. senator identified as Pete Hackett stated at a Senate hearing this week that American soldiers are actively incorporating knowledge from Ukrainian battlefield experience into U.S. military defense strategy. A senior Pentagon official at the same hearing said the department's vision is to develop real capable allies and partners rather than maximize the number of national flags involved in operations, citing Israel's Air Force as a model. Dr. Green, on the CSIS podcast, noted that Andrius Kubilius, the Lithuanian official serving as the European Union's first commissioner for defense, has been among the voices arguing for keeping doors open to Russian exiles, an indication that the EU's newly established defense portfolio is engaging with questions of Russia's long-term political trajectory. Green assessed that Europe, rather than the United States, is the more credible source of messaging toward the Russian public, given geographic proximity and relative foreign policy consistency, but that Europe has not yet reached internal consensus on what future it wishes to see for Russia. That unresolved question may be one of the most consequential open items in European strategy right now. The continent has committed tens of billions to Ukraine's defense. It has not yet agreed on what it wants to happen if and when the fighting stops. To close, the common thread across all of this week's coverage: strategic competition among major powers is accelerating, and the space for diplomatic off-ramps is shrinking on every front simultaneously. Russia's war economy is degrading but has not broken. China has structurally decided the Korean Peninsula serves its interests as a source of leverage, not as a problem to be solved. South Korea faces a Taiwan contingency with no clean strategic choice available. And the U.S.-European alliance is being tested by domestic political pressures in Washington in ways that analysts across the ideological spectrum are describing as genuinely destabilizing. None of these are new trends, but the pace at which they are moving and the degree to which they are beginning to interact with one another is what makes this moment worth paying close attention to. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for today, Friday, May 15th, 2026. We'll be back tomorrow with the next edition. Stay informed.